Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Sean Dugan of Channel 11 KTVA, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and from Fairbanks, Dermot Cole of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Judge Emmett Sullivan of Washington, D.C. says a Justice Department report on prosecutorial misconduct in the Ted Stevens case must be released. Sean, summarize the judge's ruling and when might Alaskans see this report?
Well, first, a quick correction. The report he's referring to is the one that he asked for. He appointed a special investigator, Henry Schulke. So this is the report. And he has now said that he wants that made public by March 15th. Of course, that's a few weeks from now. And I wrote this down because I wanted to get it right. Sullivan said that there was systematic concealment of significant exculpatory evidence. And he said there was widespread and, at times, intentional misconduct by Justice Department lawyers. He went so far as to say that Stevens lost the election because of the prosecution, and that it shifted the balance of power in the Senate. Now, I don't know if it would have made a difference in the 52 Democrats, I think, at the time.
Maybe he was referring to who got to be chairman of what.
It could make a difference in ranking committees.
Member, I guess, in the Republicans' case.
But right after the case was over, Sullivan appointed Schulke to look into the Justice Department's actions. Now, there's already been a few Justice Department investigations of their own. Don't know if we're going to see those. But if it does come out, it will come out March 15th. Sullivan has said he wants most of the report, if not all of it, to be out. We do know that some of the lawyers involved from the Justice Department have asked that the report not be removed from seal. But since the requests were made under seal, we don't know who it is and who it was that didn't ask or did ask. Now, interesting also, one of the prosecutors in this case committed suicide, Nicholas Marsh. His family has hired an attorney for his estate to look after his interests. So I would be surprised if we have it in our hands by March 15th. I think there's going to be some more legal wrangling on this. Now, Jill was at the actual trial in D.C.
Jill, yes, you covered many of the corruption trials, including this one. Tell us about your impression from D.C. days, and also what might this mean for many other people who were involved in the corruption trials and many who were convicted.
Well, we already saw, getting back to your last question, the convictions and penalties for at least two of those individuals were eased after they had been convicted and were in prison, Peter Kott and Vic Coring. And so that had an immediate result on two other individuals who were also wrapped up in all of this. I think the big takeaway from Judge Sullivan's order is that this was an exhaustive report an exhaustive inquiry conducted by a special prosecutor that Judge Sullivan appointed to undertake this task to determine whether or not there had been criminal misconduct by the prosecutors. And certainly, as Sean pointed out, they did make those findings. However, the special prosecutor said, I'm not recommending that we move forward with charges because they didn't violate a direct order of the court. So it's kind of this technicality which leaves it hanging out there. But Judge Sullivan, the undertone of his order that came out this week is one of being severely offended by the Justice Department, in my opinion. I saw this this judge in the courtroom. He's very commanding, he's very direct, and he can be quite thundering when he wants to be. And that also relates to the way he carries out his analysis and arguments. And he basically said, and this is my paraphrasing, but you had this very public trial. You drug this U.S. senator through a high-profile corruption trial. You held press conferences. You applauded the indictment. You applauded the conviction. And you made pledges and promises before me time and time again regarding whether or not you had been giving evidence over to the defense team as required. And it is not acceptable that taxpayers and the American public who are footing the bill for these proceedings and who watched this play out and for which had severe public consequences then have this team hide behind this cloud of secrecy about what actually took place. So I think that this judge absolutely believes in the importance of the transparency of the right to access fair and open judicial proceedings, and he wants to lay out this full record, and he said as much. And so I'm not as skeptical as Sean. I think that this has been a long process. We've already seen the attempts to try to seal information and protect some of the attorneys for whatever reason who may feel that this was not that some of this information shouldn't come out. the judge is in disagreement with them, and ultimately it's going to be his decision. I also think that the Justice Department has had a long running black eye that keeps getting reopened every time we have new information on this front. And I think they're going to want it to go away at some point, and continuing to fight it doesn't do that.
Dermot, you want to get in here for a couple minutes? Some thoughts on what you've observed?
Well, Mike, I guess the thing I'd add is I think it's important that this report be released. This might allow us to get some greater perspective and maybe some understanding about what exactly happened in this case and how it was mishandled. And once we have that, perhaps we can move into a different territory, and that is make some sense of the entire scandal, not just with the late Senator Stevens, but with the other people who were accused and convicted. And I still think we haven't done that in Alaska. We haven't sat back and reviewed just what went wrong with the legal system, and also what was wrong with the Alaska political system about the things that we know happened that are not really part of this specific inquiry.
Yeah, it is important to note that the state of Alaska, to our knowledge, has never had its own independent investigation. Sean, I wanted to, I guess you have something, but one thing I wanted to ask you, where does this leave Attorney General Eric Holder?
Well, that's a good question, because Eric Holder has gone before the Senate, specifically Senator Lisa Murkowski, on two occasions and said that, to his knowledge, no deal was made with Bill Allen to hide anything. Of course, there is evidence that the Anchorage police were investigating him for possible sexual misconduct with a teenager. Unfortunately, it was a federal offense because he brought allegedly the teenager across state lines. But there's a couple of other points I'd like to make here. One is that Judge Sullivan said that if not for his own investigation, we wouldn't know any of this misconduct. He said over and over that he tried to get the prosecutors to tell him what was going on, what they were doing, and if he had not appointed Henry Schulke, if he had not had this investigation, we wouldn't know this. So there's also some talk now about this case being the linchpin for turning changing the way that the federal government handles discovery. For instance, in most state courts, the prosecution turns over everything to the defense, and then the judge and the prosecutors and defenders work out what can and can't be used. In federal court, that's actually up to the prosecution, and this is kind of the crux of what happened. The prosecutors decide what gets turned over to the defense and what doesn't.
Right.
And so this case, you know, for 20 years, there's been lawyers in federal court have been complaining about this, have been asking for the discovery rules to be changed. They haven't had much traction on that. They do now. So if anything comes out of this in the larger picture, maybe that the federal government has to change the way that discovery is done in federal trials.
Thank you. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Sean Dugan, Jill Burke, and Dermot Cole. I guess it's the All-Irish show. I didn't think of that till just now. Sean, the Defense Department, the Obama Defense Administration, wants to move a wing of F-16 fighters from Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks to Elmendorf Fort Richardson here in South Central. A lot of Alaskans are upset, and haven't we seen this discussion before?
Well, some say we have. In 2005, they want to move the F-16 Aggressor Squadron. That's a group of F-16s they have housed up there that play the opposing forces for a lot of war games. They can also be used when we need them to respond to problems in the Arctic. But by doing so, the F-16 squadron is the largest part of Eielson Air Force Base other than the Air National Guard. And before, they had A-10s up there. Those were moved. In 2005, the Air Force proposed shuttering the base, and there was a big bunch of commission hearings, and they drug them up to Fairbanks, and Mark Hamilton and Pat Gamble led the charge on
huge public
it.
Hearings. Hundreds They're, of
they
people,
filled the yeah. Carlson yeah. Center with yeah. literally 3,000, 5,000 people in the middle of the week a few times, and as a result, they proved that the Air Force wasn't going to save any money by shuttering Eielson. This proposal, some believe, would do basically the same thing. It would start to make Eielson not matter as much and do it in pieces, what they had proposed in 2005. So the entire Alaska delegation wants proof that it's actually going to save money. They're against the change. And not for nothing, Fairbanks, you know, although the pipeline goes through Fairbanks, and I'm sure Dermot could talk to this, it's a military town. If they lose those bases, it would severely change the economy of the interior.
Let's go to Dermot. Senator Murkowski and Senator Begich, our senators, have said they'll introduce a bill that will prevent the Air Force, the Obama administration, from making this change. How do you through legislation, manage this level of strategy and tactics in the deployment of forces?
Well, this could be one of many bills that is introduced and then never goes anywhere. We really don't know yet. And the bill has been introduced, and the senators have said that they're really going to fight this plan. The difficulty for Alaska, or at least for interior Alaska, is that by proposing to move the F-16s to Anchorage, we just have to think about how this is going to be viewed outside. This is an in-state transfer, so people outside are going to say, well, what do you guys have to complain about? Alaska is not losing anything here. So the politics of this are kind of dicey. People in the Fairbanks area are very concerned about this. As Sean said, military is a major part of the economy. And some say it's around 15-16% of this region's economy. So the Air Force is a significant part of that. The best bet, according to some people here, is to acknowledge that this is going to keep coming up again and again. And maybe people in the Fairbanks area need to try to find if there's another mission for Eielson Air Force Base. For instance, you know, there's some bases overseas that could be closed and missions moved here. This needs to be played out in Washington, D.C., and people here are just going to be saying, you know, for strategic reasons, the base should continue.
I think, Dermot, the other thing to note here is that the whole aura of the country is so much different now than when the BRAC process last addressed Eielson. Now the federal government is in a severe financial bind, and the military is determined to make significant changes in its force deployment and costs, right?
That's correct, Mike. The other thing is that Senator Stevens is not in Washington, right, D.C. anymore. And the politics have changed dramatically since that time. And there's great concern in Fairbanks that this is going to go ahead and that it will not be overturned.
Thank you very much. Jill, former federal fisheries regulator Arnie Fugelvogt, who also was a staff assistant to Lisa Murkowski, is sentenced in federal court for abusing the fisheries system and profiting illegitimately. The judge had some hard words for him. Tell us the latest on this case. Give us the update from the courtroom.
Well, he had, Mr. Fugelvogt entered this plea deal in April. It became public in August. He resigned the day before the charges came out. He was basically admitted to illegal fishing during a time when he was a regulator within the fishing industry, which was deeply offensive to a lot of people.
North Pacific Fisheries Management Commission.
Yes.
A very important agency.
Yes, and he was actually at one time considered for the top position within that agency. So he admitted that he had falsely reported where he'd been catching flatfish, halibut, and the prosecutors decided or found that he had made a profit and illegal gain by selling those illegally reported fish. And over the course of all of the investigation, I think it spanned 4 or 5 years that they went back and looked at records and documents and talked to people, they estimated he probably took in about $1 million based on profits and gains from those illegal sales. He was only charged with one instance, which was about $100,000 worth of value.
Presumably, that's because prosecutors are obligated to only bring charges they believe they can prove.
That and if he was being helpful in other ways, they don't have to bring everything forward. And we know that he was being helpful in other ways. So when this all came public in August, the two sides had agreed that 10 months was a reasonable time frame, that he should get 10 months in jail. Here we are at the sentencing, and he gets 5 months in jail, which is what the prosecution team recommended based on his substantial assistance to them in other ongoing fisheries investigations.
And as our friend, the defense attorney, the prominent defense attorney, Jeff Feldman, reminds us, cooperating and being a snitch are not the same thing.
They are not the same thing, and he also said that it is very challenging when you come from small fishing communities to be talking frankly with prosecutors about your friends and people that you have known a long, long time. And this is not a task that Mr. Fugelvogt has taken on easily. So the question is, who is he rolling on and how many of them are there? He's a pretty big fish in all of this in terms of the political impact.
So this is clearly not over.
This is not over. We know of at least one other fisherman from the Oregon area who was fishing Fugelvog's boat, who's also now facing federal charges. There may be others, and there was a reference to ongoing cases, so we'll see where it goes. But he definitely got a break from the prosecution team when they recommended this sentence, and the judge upheld it.
And here's one thing that was unclear to me. He's not going to resume a career as a regulator or a legislative staffer, but can he resume a career as a boat operator who gets permits and can fish in the waters?
I believe so. I mean, there's nothing written out in the plea agreement saying I won't take a job as a commercial fisherman. But he has sold off his equipment and his reputation is in the gutter. I mean, I think the tone was that he has basically sunk himself with respect to.
And he's not an old man, but he's old enough to be hard to start over.
He's 48 years old.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. The State Alaska Resources Committee of the Alaska State Senate was talking oil taxes this week. Dermot Cole, they heard some compelling testimony or quite interesting testimony from Robin Brenna about Judge Gleason's decision in a recent tax case in Fairbanks. I watched this and so did you. What did we hear from Attorney Brenna? First of all, who is he and why was he there?
Well, Mike, Robin Brenna is an attorney from Anchorage. He likes to refer to himself as an attorney from Skagway because that's where he was born and grew up. But he's a real expert on this issue of pipeline tariffs and tax cases related to that. He's been involved in these for many years, representing Tesoro, Anadarko, and most recently the Fairbanks North Star Borough. He was joined by Craig Richards, is another attorney from Anchorage, and they spoke to the Senate Resources Committee about this decision by Judge Sharon Gleason, which basically said that the pipeline is worth about $9 billion compared to the $1 billion that the oil companies believe it's worth, and that it probably has several decades worth of life left in it. The importance to this in the current debate is that the discussion about the pipeline shutting down within a few years should be put to rest by this decision. It doesn't put to rest the debate over production rates, which is a separate issue. But the question of whether or not the pipeline is going to shut down within a few years is pretty much conclusively demonstrated to be false by the documents that were revealed in this case.
And Dermot, if I might just, we can't really do eye contact here from Fairbanks, but the documents were the oil company's own documents, their own internal documents, right?
Well, particularly from BP, which has been studying efforts to operate at reduced levels until late in this century, and also booking reserves with the Securities and Exchange Commission until well after mid-century. And it is those documents that really played a key part in the judge's decision. So if I had to summarize what Brenna and Richard said, it's that there's a lot of information that the state policymakers don't have or don't look at when they are considering what's really going on with the oil industry. And some of this information that was revealed in this case is the type of thing that lawmakers and the administration, frankly, should be analyzing and digesting.
Can you briefly remind us what Brenna had to say about the tariffs, which is not a subject most of us follow on a day-to-day basis?
Well, this is one of his long-standing issues before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, particularly for Anadarko and Tesoro in the past. And The assertion is that high tariff rates by integrated companies are a barrier to competition from new companies getting involved in the North Slope oil business. The idea is if you have an integrated company, which is what we have with ConocoPhillips, BP, and Exxon, is that they not only own the oil leases on the slope, they own the pipeline, the tankers, and the refineries. So you can't tell where the profits are anywhere along that chain, and profits or losses in one area can be covered by profits or losses somewhere else. And Brenna's main point is that system makes it difficult for new companies to break into the business.
Yeah, he was quite explicit about that. Okay, thank you very much, Dermot. Sean, a barista disappears here in Anchorage. I think it's about a week now, and the whole town is gripped by the story. Posters appear all over town. Rewards are offered. Police are on this 24 hours a day. Citizens get involved, and we even hear occasionally from a psychic or two who says alleges they know what's going on. It's Friday afternoon when we're recording this, but what's the summary at this point?
Well, at this point, the police have said they are making progress. They won't say what that progress is. Samantha Koenig was abducted from her coffee stand, Common Grounds, which is on a corner of Tudor and Old Seward. It's in the parking lot of the Alaska Club there. She was taken somewhere between 8 and, I believe, 7 and 9 p.m. on Wednesday. And according to the police, the video surveillance shows that she was extremely afraid of whomever it was that took her, so they assume the man or person had a weapon. Now, there have been a lot of people come forward. There's been a lot of publicity on this case, not only flyers, but now other coffee shops are on the actual coffee cup as a picture
that's
of
quite
Samantha.
Yeah.
They've kind of banded together, and you know, we have a lot of coffee shops in this town, and a lot of them employ young women to man the stands, and they work late at night and sometimes by themselves. So now conversations are being had about how to mitigate that. But as far as Samantha and her family, you know, a lot of people are coming forward. There's a $41,000 reward out there. As you mentioned, Anchorage police have gotten calls from psychics. I'm sure the reward is part of that. People calling themselves private investigators have tried to insert themselves into some of the searches. The bottom line is, you know, police say if you have a tip, give it to them, but otherwise kind of get out of the way because, you know, things like that can hurt the case. Just last night, somebody was going on Facebook saying that Samantha Koenig's body was found, and that got back to the family, which then necessitated a tweet from APD saying that that was not true. So,
what do you think it is that gets the public's attention so deeply in this story? Is it one that's just so personal, or is it every family's daughter? Or
I think it's part of that, but I think many of us actually go to coffee stands and we see these people. So, you know,
the actual
coffee drinkers, I think, that go to the stands are now considering the safety of these girls and the community as a whole, because coffee stands are kind of an Anchorage phenomenon. I think that because of these, we have, last time they checked, a cup of coffee available for every 33,000 or 3,300 people. There's a coffee stand in Anchorage, which was the highest per capita in the country. So there's a lot of them out there. I'm glad that we're having a conversation about their safety now. I'm hopeful that we can have that conversation after Samantha is found safe and sound. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it has been a week, and the police aren't really saying what the leads are. And another part of this is they do have the surveillance tape, but they're not releasing it. And there's been some pressure on them to release that so the public could have more information.
They're going to say it's part of an ongoing investigation.
They are, and I suspect, you know, that the tape was probably fairly grainy just from the police's own statements on whether or not there was a weapon, and if it was a man or a woman, it doesn't seem like they have a good handle on that. But
okay, Jill, we'd be remiss without an update on Schaefer Cox and the Sovereign Citizens of Fairbanks. What's the latest in their battles in court?
Okay, so the most recent is that they have basically lost their effort to discredit the obtaining of the search warrants and the evidence that were gathered. They had at a hearing attempted to say, look, the agents didn't tell the truth. It didn't go down the way they said it was. One of these informants is not just a liar. He's a super bad liar, and he's done it for a long, long time. And the judge should have known that he wasn't just a felon, but that he was a felon with a long trail of disaster before deciding to rely on his word. And the judge just basically blocked them at every turn. So they're still headed for trial in May. I expect we'll see more evidentiary battles between now and then. Interesting, I think, on a more national scale, is that the Schaefer Cox case represents part of what is this heightening consciousness from law enforcement officials, including the FBI, about what they term sovereign citizen extremists. Not sovereign citizens, but extremists. Somebody who is fueled by an ideological perspective to commit an act of violence or some type of criminal activity. And they're worried about these. Law enforcement officers have been hurt and killed. And if you look at what Cox is accused of, his case has many of the hallmarks of the indicators of these extremist groups or individuals that the FBI is concerned about. These kind of bizarre court filings and these clogging the paper, you know, clogging the court system with paper terrorism, they call it. And then also certainly making threats against law enforcement officials, judges, and others.
We're going to have to go to Dermot Cole quickly. Dermot, I know this is a tough assignment, but can you tell us in a minute and a half the latest on the reapportionment battle in Fairbanks? A state judge has ruled against the apportionment board in several instances.
All right, Mike, the the Alaska Redistricting Board and the attorney for the two plaintiffs in this case are appealing the judge's decision. The judge determined that four districts are unconstitutional and need to be withdrawn. The next step for this is the Alaska Supreme Court in March. The redistricting board is agreeing on two of the districts, two Fairbanks districts that are going to be withdrawn. It's challenging two others. The plaintiffs are saying that Fairbanks is still not getting a fair deal out of this, and that's going to be the focus of their appeal with the Alaska Supreme Court. Just following the same practice as in other years, redistricting is going to end up with the Alaska Supreme Court making one of the final calls on this.
Okay, we are about out of time. Thank you, Dermot, for that brief but elegant summary. We'll be off next week. The art auction is going to be replacing us, but we'll be back in 2 weeks with Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.